edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. For a short time, probably until around the end of May, you can save a full 20% on both Crossover Linux Standard and Crossover Linux Professional, and now even the Crossover Server. And you can do so while helping LQ in the process. To do this, you can use the code LQCO20 when placing your Crossover Office order. And like I said, that'll save you a full 20% off of the retail price, and the proceeds will also go to LQ. I'll place a link to that in the show notes at radio.linuxquestions.org. Another quick update. Over the past, actually many months now, I've been referencing an upcoming code upgrade, and I'm happy to announce that things on that are solidifying, and you should definitely see that code upgrade, hopefully within the next week or a couple of weeks at the shortest, and I'll have some more details on that after it's been released. Now, on to the news. The first story I have is Open Source is Bad for Vendors. And this is a look at open source from kind of a different perspective, if you will, and it's from a Computer World article, and here's a snippet from that. Quote, I chaired an interesting meeting the other day. It was me against senior executives of Cisco, Agilent Technologies, and Novell. The subject was, do enterprise users really want open source? Are you strongly supporting this? Open source is not a movement, it's a religion. It is a set of principles and practices that let everyone share non-existent or semi-existent intellectual property. Remember the Communist Manifesto. From each according to his abilities, to each according to his need. It is this generation's Woodstock. Back to the meeting, these vendors were tripping over themselves swearing allegiance to the open source movement. It was like Republicans genuflecting at the graven images of Ronald Reagan. And they were testifying that the really smart enterprise users, REEUs, were actually demanding, lots of solutions here. And each of them was going to be first in line. Naturally, I disagreed, partially because I'm a naturally disagreeable person. Any idiot can make friends, but can you make some really serious enemies? I disagreed, however, because allegiance to open source depends on who you are. End quote. Now, as you have probably may have guessed, I disagree here. Open source is definitely not a religion. And while there are a few very vocal people that kind of get a lot of press who may treat it near the brink of it being a religion, the reality is for the rest of us, it was a much, much more pragmatic decision. And the following is a quote from a ZDNet post that actually led me to that Computer World article. Quote, Howard Anderson has a moan out today, complaining that open source is very, very bad for vendors. He's right. Vendors have trod the computing world like kings for decades. Open source changes the market's dynamics. Open source reduces a vendor's power in customer relationships. Open source also reduces a vendor's hold on key employees who can now walk out the door and continue working on what the vendor is selling. That's the idea of open source. There are two sides in every market relationship, and the boss's side is just one of them. Customers want to reduce the control vendors have over them, which in the computer business is enormous. Employees want to enhance their bargaining power, not just to make more money, but to do work they like. End quote. Now, in my opinion, what you see here is the computer software business as a whole is maturing, and like almost all industries before it, that means major changes for the entire ecosystem. And in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of most people at this point, vendors have had far too much control. And it was inevitable that this had to change. It always does, and history is a good guide here. That really, at the crux of it, has nothing to do with open source per se. Open source was just a catalyst for something that was going to happen anyway. And moving a little bit back towards the pragmatic side of things, open source produces better software. It's also much better in the end for consumers. Now, does that mean it's bad for vendors? I would argue no, not necessarily. Now, if you were used to being able to collect monopoly rents or really hold your consumers hostage, then it does mean that you're going to have to change. But for those that do change, very profitable times are still ahead. And I think one thing that many people are far too focused on and kind of get caught up in is the gratis part of quote-unquote free software. And this seems to still be especially rampant in some of the enterprise spaces, some sectors specifically. And I don't know if that's due to the marketing that's aimed at those enterprise sectors or what, but you need to look at the value that a vendor provides. And the fact that you may not be paying for artificially shrink-wrapped bits does not mean you're getting a free ride. The value proposition has just changed. And I think I forget, and many people forget, how hard that is to understand if it's a new concept to you. And it's something I think we need to make clear. But many are doing a good job of that already, and I think very good times are ahead for some. The next story I have is Red Hat to build global desktop. And there's quite a bit of news coming out over the last week from the Red Hat Summit. And I really would have liked to attend this. Somehow the date slipped by me and I just didn't get a chance to book it. So hopefully next year. Now, one of the major announcements that was made was the global desktop. And this is a quote from one of the articles that covered the Red Hat Summit. Quote, Red Hat is preparing to release a new global desktop that over time will grow into an online desktop which integrates online services into a client desktop platform. The platform will allow users to access online and local data in a unified way. Red Hat has teamed up with Intel for the platform. Local PC manufacturers will build the actual systems. The software borrows from the One Laptop Per Child, or OLPC, project, with about 95% of the code overlapping. The OLPC uses an adapted version of Red Hat's Fedora Linux. The global desktop won't share the OLPC's sugar user interface, but will come bundled with applications such as Firefox and OpenOffice. The first version of the software is due out in June and will use a traditional user interface. Subsequent updates will move to a model where traditional applications are integrated with online services, said Red Hat Chief Technology Officer Brian Stevens. It will take online services and integrate them richly into a client desktop, and make them first-class citizens with the traditional applications, Stevens said in a keynote at the Red Hat Summit in San Diego. Integrating online services with local data is required for the next-generation desktop, he argued. Data will be pulled onto the client using service-oriented architectures, or SOAs. End quote. Now, note that after doing a little bit of research on this, this has two very specific target markets, and that's emerging markets and the enterprise. And this doesn't seem like something that's meant to be used for mass consumer adoption, at least not yet. And while the merging of online and offline seem inevitable long term, the details to getting that system to work for the average person just isn't quite there yet. There's just too many times where you might be on an airplane or on the tube or insert many random places where there just isn't access for this to work today. Now, however, once apps like Firefox, and this is going to start already with version 3, can seamlessly give me access to apps while I'm offline and then sync when access becomes available, this is going to trickle into the mainstream quite quickly, I think. And by targeting markets for which this technology is good enough right now, Red Hat is positioning themselves really well to pounce when the opportunity is right. It seems to me that a perfect partner on this one would be Google, but I haven't seen any official word on that front. But you have to assume that when they're talking about SOAs, Red Hat is not going to own it and be able to operate the number of architectures that people are going to want. So partnering clearly is the way they're going to do this. Who they partner with should be interesting. The next story I have is Sun hopes for Linux-like Solaris. So it looks like Ian is already making a difference at Sun. Here's a quote from the article. In an effort to spur adoption of Solaris, Sun Microsystems has begun a project, codenamed Indiana, to try to give its operating system some of the trappings of Linux. The project is one of the items on the to-do list of Ian Murdoch, founder of the Debian version of Linux, and as of March, Sun's chief operating systems officer. Though he wouldn't confirm the name of the project, Murdoch, who's from Indiana, discussed the project's essence at the Java 1 conference in the U.S. this week, and Sun spokesman Russ Castronovo confirmed the name. Sun has been trying for years to restore the luster of Solaris, a version of Unix that peaked in popularity in the late 1990s, but that has since faced a strong challenge, chiefly from Linux. Sun has worked to reinvigorate Solaris by boosting its performance, offering it as a free download, making it an open source project called OpenSolaris, and pushing a version that runs on servers using Intel's and AMD's mainstream x86 processors. Linux and Solaris are cousins that stem from the same Unix heritage, if not from the same source code. But Linux fans simply have a hard time trying Solaris, Murdoch said on Tuesday. It's too unfamiliar. There's a gulf, Murdoch said in an interview. We need to make it familiar to people who know Linux inside and out. End quote. You have to admit this. Solaris user land has historically been quite painful for the average Linux user, and it's kind of easy to take the niceties of the GNU tools for granted until you have to live without them. And in Solaris, you typically did have to live without them. You know, all the commands you're used to from grep and awk and sed and even tar are the same names, just different switches, and typically much less functionality. Now, Solaris 10 has changed some of this, but most of it involves either installing additional packages or messing with your path. A lot of the typical GNU tools are now installed by default. They're just not first in your path, so you have to switch that. That being said, there are some really compelling things about Solaris 10, from ZFS to Dtrace and even Zones, just to name a few. But getting the user land issue sorted could be a big win for Sun here. Now, why they do this, and for instance, why the most would contend better tools are not first in your path, is that Solaris has typically had a huge focus on backwards compatibility. You know, you can tar up something written for Solaris 7, say, which came out in like 99, untarred on Solaris 10, and it typically will just work. So whether they can roll these upgraded tools and a better user land in while keeping that backwards compatibility remains to be seen. But if they can, will Solaris then turn into kind of an ABI stable version of Linux? And that's what time will tell. A quick disclosure on this story. During a recent market dip, I decided it was worthwhile to take a small position in Sun W. And while that, like I said, is very small, and it certainly won't change my opinion on how I blog or what I do podcasts about. The last story I have is Novell confirms the patent deal gave it access to Microsoft IP. Matthew Aslett has some more information from Novell on the patent agreement with Microsoft. Here's a quote from the article in CBR. Quote, last week I noted that a new explanation had emerged as to why Novell entered into a patent agreement with Microsoft. Because Novell's engineers required sanctioned access to Microsoft's code in order to develop open source interoperability without violating Microsoft's IP. I asked Novell to confirm whether this was correct and received an interesting response from Justin Steinman, Director of Marketing for Linux and Open Platforms at Novell, in which he confirmed the explanation and stated that it was not new but had been overlooked by the press and community. The statement from Steinman was as follows. Since we announced the Novell-Microsoft agreement in November, we've always said that the intellectual property agreement provided a foundation for the interoperability between Windows and SUSE Linux Enterprise. This foundation falls into two primary categories. The covenant not to sue, which provides customers with peace of mind when they deploy SUSE Linux Enterprise. And two, the IP access necessary for the technical collaboration to deliver interoperability between Windows and Linux. For better or worse, the community and press at large have focused on number one, although Novell has talked about both categories since we signed the agreement. As you know, engineers at Novell and Microsoft are hard at work on our technical collaboration, and we demonstrated the first results at BrainShare in March. But in order to deliver the interoperability between Novell eDirectory and Microsoft Active Directory, as well as the bidirectional virtualization between Windows and SUSE Linux Enterprise, Novell required sanctioned access to Microsoft's code in order to develop open-source interoperability without violating Microsoft's intellectual property. End quote. And despite the almost egregious overuse of the word interoperability in that official statement, that sounds a little more reasonable than some of the previously given explanations. And the really perplexing part here to me is why this is all kind of slowly coming out in bits. Given the initial community reaction, which was decidedly negative, you'd think Novell would have been crystal clear of the reasons and the benefits from day one. And their action caused people, and probably for the most part reasonably in my opinion, given the circumstances, to assume the worst. At this point now, a huge amount of damage has been done to Novell, not only from an image and trust point of view, but also from a staffing and recruiting point of view. You know, they lost a ton of good talent, and some new talent that would potentially have gone there is probably not. And both of these things, both trust and staffing, are absolutely critical in the commercial open source world. It's going to be interesting to see how they attempt to recover and what kind of move they make going forward. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.